Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the debrief. It's Dave O'Neill here, and yes, my COVID editions where I'm just ringing comics randomly. Well, not that randomly. I give them notice sometimes to talk about what's going on. Now, I've never spoken to Titus O'Reilly before. I've certainly worked with him a bit, and he's a great guy and a great comic, a football-focused comic based in Melbourne. And if you're going to be a football-focused comic, that's probably the place to be, even though footy's big in Adelaide and Perth, and the AFL would like to believe Sydney and Brisbane, but we know that's not true. But anyway, he's had an interesting story. I always love someone who just turns up and starts a career. I absolutely love it. So let's wake up the man that is Titus O'Reilly.
Hello.
Titus, it's Dave O'Neill. How are you?
Dave O'Neill, as I live and breathe.
I'm recording right away. I'll get straight into it, Titus. We don't muck around.
Oh, mate, you're quick. Very low tech.
Very low tech. Well, it's I'm recording you on a machine, and you're on the phone, so you're not on a landline, but you're on a mobile now.
Yes.
Now, Titus, how are you going? Because you're a Melbournian like myself, and you're obviously a well-known football comedian. How are you going in COVID, in the lockdown?
Well, I feel barracking for Melbourne all my life has really prepared me for
self-isolation. You know,
well, and no hope for the future.
Hey, well, I don't know when Melbourne are playing next, but there's a chance aren't they at number 9 at the moment or somewhere?
Yeah, they need a win, and then which is always a doubtful thing for them, and then they need someone else to lose.
Right.
So like a lot of things in life, it's not enough that you win; someone else must lose.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, that's what they say. You know, success is—you've got to see your friends fail, isn't that the old saying?
That's the old saying.
Poor old Melbourne—they can't—they can't win a trip. Anyway, look. I mean, everyone loves to hang shit on Melbourne. I got a soft spot for them. I've done a few gigs for Melbourne, and you know, I quite like Russell Robertson. He's a nice guy. So he's former Melbourne, isn't he? Russell?
Yeah. No, nice everyone guy. Kind of says to me, the worst thing about being a Melbourne supporter is everyone says to you, I don't mind you guys. It's because we're the non-threat.
The AFL. Whereas Richmond are like, oh, nah, I can't like them. They're too good, you know.
Yeah, no, if you're winning a lot, no one will like you, but we've never threatened that. So everyone's quite happy to say we're their second team because we don't beat them that often.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember where I first met you. I think it was at Nova in Melbourne, maybe? Do you reckon?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was at Nova, yeah.
I think it was because you do a regular football segment and I fill in a bit because Sam Pang's work shy and doesn't turn up. And
He's an incredibly lazy man.
He is. And because you've had a remarkable career in that. Because I remember seeing you on TV or hearing you on the radio in your former life as you're a crisis manager. Were you not a PR kind of... I don't want to say spin doctor, but no, you were kind of like a spin doctor, weren't you?
No, I'd worked in comms all my life, so you know, I didn't.
That's
really...
communications for the layperson. Yeah.
Yeah, we shorten it in the biz. And I sort of stumbled in the comedy by originally complete accident, and then once I sort of realised I might be able to do it as a day job, I worked pretty hard at it. But,
yes. Yeah, well, that's interesting. What age were you? Around what age were you when you started? Your 30s, you would have been?
I would have been early 30s, maybe. Yeah, so
yeah, that's late to start in comedy. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of people I know now who are in comedy, you know, there's not really a set pathway all the time of how you come into it.
There's, no.
And then it was also, I think in the past, if you want to do, I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily be stand-up comedy, any type of comedy, whether it's writing or anything. Remember the days, if you wanted to work on radio, you had to start by being a cadet somewhere, usually at a community radio station, and then you just you hung around, and if you hung around long enough and people liked you internally, they might give you an option. And the same with writing for newspapers or,
TV shows.
TV and all that. It was all a bit of a closed shop that you had to go through these very arduous things. But with social media, if anyone starts putting their stuff out there, whatever they do, even if they don't expect it to actually really catch on, if it catches on, you suddenly find yourself with an audience.
Yeah, so that's what you did, and you did a bit of Triple R, didn't you? I mean, I'm ex-Triple R.
Yeah, I started a Twitter account and a blog about footy, which I did.
The blog,
and
I love it.
Yeah, it was I started off doing it with no intention of it going anywhere.
Yeah.
It really was. I thought it was like me with the gym, like start all enthusiastic, do it for 2 weeks, then you suddenly haven't done it for a few, and then before you know it, you kind of consign it to the past.
And you drive past and every day past the gym and go, oh, I'm paying money to that joint. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm also, because one of the things about being too lazy to go to the gym is I'm also too lazy to cancel the recurring payment.
Yes. We've all been there.
So I started to do it, and it just sort of kind of started to take off slowly, not like in a big way at first, but it was like, suddenly a few people were writing it and commenting, and I found I liked it as just, a hobby. It was a sideline hobby. But then it just suddenly started to really take off. And then I think, once you've got a bit of an audience, other people start to approach you and say, we like your stuff, why don't you come do this? So I did a bit of Triple R, did a bit of Triple M, ended up at Nova.
Yeah. Now you're on the front bar, et cetera.
Yeah.
Which is huge.
Started doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Which, as you know, isn't hard.
No. It's easy. Well, particularly, I mean, you do a lot of... I've done... you came and did the pub that I run, and we did a football-themed night, but you do a lot of those gigs before the games at, like, the MCG or Etihad or wherever, or in Adelaide. You go to Adelaide and do that. And they're not easy, those gigs, because I've done them, and you turn up to a function room where people have... Either their company's paid a couple hundred dollars or they've paid a couple hundred dollars to watch the game, but they've got to sit through a average meal and some ex-footballers talking and then a comedian. And I don't think they're easy gigs, I've got to say.
Well, they're hard. I think the thing I think about those gigs, so people aren't familiar, they have the president of the club or have president of functions, and it's sponsors and corporate types.
Everyone's wearing a tie and stuff.
Everyone's wearing a tie, seated. Yeah. It can be between, and it usually starts about 2 hours before the game, and then everyone goes out and watches the game. And so it's a very interesting atmosphere, and then I've done a lot of them. There can be between sort of 500 to 2,000 people in those rooms.
Yeah.
And I do I've done for the AFL the last 2 grand finals. I won't be doing it this year, I don't think, due to the quarantine requirements. But the room on grand final day, which I've done 10-minute sets at the last 2 years, in the room, and the table in front of you is the Richard Goyder, who's the head of the AFL, Gillon McLachlan, the Prime Minister, the Premier of Victoria, for Daniel Andrews, last couple of years. It's got, who else is there? It's got, in the room is like David Koch, Jeff Kennett, CEOs of BHP,
Eddie McGuire,
Kerry Stokes. So it's that everyone in the room is someone, and you've got to kind of get up in front of all of them.
So how do you approach that?
Well, I think the main thing I say is that... The first thing I realise when I do those corporate gigs, and I think some comedians I've seen do it make the mistake, they'll get up and do their act from a club, which, as you know, is a very different environment. So, especially if you or I are doing our own comedy festival show, everyone that's bought a ticket is there to see you. So they've sort of self-selected that they like your sense of humour.
Yes.
And they've... come to watch you be funny. So that's their whole purpose. So, it's the more well-known you get in some ways, performing becomes easy because you're no longer fronting a bunch of drunks who don't know who you are. You're actually fronting people who know who you are and often like you. And so the goodwill is in the room at the start.
But and also, you talk specifically about football, I bet. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah. But the thing I find with these corporate gigs that you've got to do is, one, you've got to remember you're not the reason anyone's there.
Exactly. Like,
so to do that, you kind of got to have a completely different mindset and approach to your material, because yes. I think it does help if you're talking about football.
Definitely.
Because they're there for football, so they're all going to be into it to an extent.
Yeah.
I find too, I always, and this sounds like a silly little thing to notice, but I've said it to a few comedians who do these ones occasionally, and they say, what's your tip? My number one tip is don't get up and do it as stand-up. So don't get up and have a mic and wander around. Do it behind the podium like you're doing a speech.
Yeah, you've told me this. I remember this tip. Yes.
Yeah, because at those functions, lots of people get up and do speeches. So they're kind of, when you get up and you've got a podium and you're looking like you're giving a humorous speech rather than a stand-up act, they're kind of, they relax with that kind of setup.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, okay, yes. It's a weird little thing. But when the minute someone gets up and grabs the mic and starts to do their club act, everyone tenses and goes, oh my God, are they going to ask me something? Or
this is
obviously a comedy bit.
Yeah.
But if you give up and deliver it like it's a speech, but happen to be funny, they all go, that was a really funny speech.
Yeah.
So I find that you kind of got to recognize that it's not straight stand-up like you and I would do if we were doing comedy festivals, where if you got up at the comedy festival behind a podium, people would go, what's this guy doing? Yeah,
he's a bit of a wanker, I think that would be the term used. But I think you're right, but I've done some where you do two or three gigs in the same day, and I did one for Carlton, and I did the Old Carltonians,
which is a
fan-based group of older guys who love Carlton, right? And they were fantastic. And there was only about 50 of them, maybe, in a small room at the MCG or Eddie Had or wherever. And the president was sitting down the front. Everyone had to finish. He was a large guy, and he had this bit of chicken. He was trying to get every bit of meat off it. And I just paused and said, mate, there's no more meat left on that chicken. Trust me. It was very funny. And with all those Carlton gigs, I always do the, and we've got the underbelly table over here, give them a round of applause. And that got a huge laugh.
Yeah,
but then I got ushered into the president's lunch, which, as you said, is a more formal occasion. Chris Judd was there. Oh, I don't know who's the head of Carlton. It's It's one of the Smorgans, or who's it? It's one of those guys, the big business.
No, Mark Ludice is.
Oh yeah, Smorgans Bulldogs, isn't he? And I do the underbelly joke, and it gets a ooh.
I felt like
in that room next door, I was killing. Now, and I remember the woman ushered me off stage with her hand on my back and pushed you along. Like, she goes, we don't like references to underbelly. It's like, okay.
But that comes down a bit to, which is where, to me, and some comedians would say, well, this is ridiculous. You know, as a comedian, you're there to push the envelope and do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, but not always.
But the thing with those gigs is, it comes back to my point, you're not the reason they came to see you.
Yeah,
so, you know, when they come and see you do comedy, they kind of, like at a gig, they kind of want you at your, not worst, but they want you to push the envelope. They've kind of almost, the public are giving you permission.
Yes.
But even then, you can sometimes, it is amazing to me, you know, all sorts of comedy, where sometimes you'll make a joke and the whole audience will go, ooh. Like, occasionally I'll make a Wayne Carey joke.
Yeah.
About his terrible, you know,
behavior.
Violence towards various police and women. And I'll make a joke about it, and the audience will go, ooh. And it's like, I didn't do it. He did it. Why are you... I'm just stating something that factually happened. It just reminds you that people often in groups don't want to be reminded of certain truths.
Oh, yeah. I did a debate against him for a charity once at the MCG. And I just had a... I don't know him, you know. I mean, and I had a real crack at him. Gee, I left the room really quickly. I tell you what, because he's a big man. he looked happy. But you're right. As soon as I mentioned... I said something about a barbecue in Warrandyte, you know, which was where one of the incidents occurred, and all the audience know what I'm referring to. They're like, ooh.
Yeah, I know. Because they're not used to the person being in the room.
Yes.
So you know, they sort of, they don't want him to see them laughing.
I know.
There might be scores settled later on.
And the other person I was debating was Cameron Ling. Now, you can't, what can you say about Cameron Ling? You know, he's like a nice guy. So, anyway.
Yeah.
I said he's big, I said he's big in Geelong, which is like being, you know, good looking in Colac, I think the line was. The mayor of Geelong, they call him. Have you had any footballers come up to you or any of these football types have a crack back on Twitter or to you, or they're pretty good generally?
I've had most of it's like the people that approach you. I more get players who would, because I tend to bag players who do stupid things or are known as terrible people. I tend to get other players going, oh God, you say what everyone thinks, but they would never say it.
Yeah,
so they sort of tell me secretly.
Yeah, right.
So I get a lot of that. There's a few people out there who aren't big fans of mine though, but you get it secondhand that they don't like you. They're not real. I think some of them wouldn't want to acknowledge your presence by actually letting you know you annoy them.
And I found football fans, and I'm not talking about the players or the media, but actual fans are rabid. I was just making a joke about who's the Seventh-day Adventist Richmond player who retired. You know him, big guy, he was a backman.
Alex Rance.
I had to go, just a joke, and oh my God, the Tiger Army turned on me, Titus. It was ugly. So they really, fans are really, they're really feral, aren't they?
Well, you get this in all walks of life, because I'll say a joke and say I'm bagging, you know, Richmond. I'll get all these people laughing at it, and then I'll bag Carlton, and someone will say, Titus, I usually like your jokes, but
yeah.
I found that out of line. And then you look and find out they're a Carlton supporter, and they like the Richmond jokes, but they didn't like the... And it reminds me a bit being in Melbourne at the moment, people are falling into this thing of, you're not allowed to bag the Morrison government and the Andrews government. It's like they get annoyed. You got to kind of pick a side.
Oh, okay, It's
reminding me a lot of football.
Yes.
But in football, football fans at least admit where their team is failing and say, yeah, we're a great club, but we're terrible at the moment. You go on Twitter and you make any comment about it, anything to do with the lockdown, and you'll get half the people on there piling on to point out all the flaws you have as a human being, which is quite refreshing. You know, I used to have to leave the house to be insulted.
Yes, true. Twitter brings it to your front door, to your phone. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I've got a friend who rings me up. We won't name him. We'll just call him Husey, and he's like, "Are you stand with Dan? You stand with Dan? You voted for him." I said, I can't remember who I voted for, but he's made some mistakes. There's no doubt about it. So I'm not completely a Dan man, that's for sure. But
I think too, don't you think the modern world is people say things like, what do you think about this AFL rule change? Or what do you think about this government team? Or what do you think about this issue? And you're no longer to go, I think I don't really like it, but actually, they don't follow up with you rating how much you actually care about it.
Yeah.
So so people are like, this is the worst thing that ever happened or the greatest thing, rather than, I find this when people have debates like the Herald Sun and various things go on about transgender things. And so you get one group saying everything should happen and it's no problem. And another group will say, you know, it shouldn't be allowed. And there's people who I think the majority of people going, I got no problem with it, but to be honest, it has no impact on my day-to-day life.
Yeah.
No one ever says that anymore. They all act like these things are confronting issues to their every waking moment. Like, you know, that they're just constantly inundated, you know, with transgender people talking to them, when most of them wouldn't have ever
met one. No.
But they have this visceral reaction to the issue one way or the other. And I just find that. Because I'm a big believer in not caring about a lot of things, and remember when we used to not stand for the national anthem or care about it?
That's
what sort of made us Australian.
Yes,
a complete lack of interest.
Yes,
you know, and now people say, "Oh, the national anthems." Someone's not going to like if someone had said someone didn't stand for the national anthem 10 years ago or when I was growing up. Everyone would go, oh, yeah, that was Uncle Derek. He just couldn't be asked.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be like, he's making it's a disgrace and he's dishonouring the entire, you know, Australian military back in history. You know, they'd just go, yeah, whatever.
I love it. I love it. So you did you start about 10 years ago, you said? About 10 years ago?
Yeah, 10 years ago.
That's amazing. And so when you started in your normal job, did people do the little thing at work where they go, how's your little comedy hobby going? How's that? Were they aware of what you were doing?
One or two people were. I didn't tell everyone, but
no.
Some. Well, you know what's funny about this? And people sometimes will say to me, I'm thinking of getting into comedy or writing or whatever. Yeah. You know, so it might be they're doing, like, want to start a football blog or whatever. And they'll say, oh, I'm really worried about, you know, I've got to get the design right or the name right or the logo right or all this stuff right. And I'm worried about what people say. And I just point out to them at the start, no one cares.
Yes.
That's the reality you're going to be up against. Not that people are going, oh, I can't believe you're starting this comedy blog. Like,
I don't like your logo. Yeah. Yeah.
No, just no one cared. That was my problem. I would have loved if they were all fired up about it and had opinions. But you'd say to people, what do you think of it? And they'd go, I don't know, I've read it.
Yeah.
You'd go, okay. So that was the main reaction I got was you're more going to be worried about people worry about the wrong things. They worry about being embarrassed when you should be more worried about complete and utter disinterest.
Yes. You're right. That's more of a factor, absolutely, when you start.
Well, that's the more likely thing that's going to happen, isn't it, when you start? I mean, it's like when you do your first gig, people go, oh, what if I bomb? And you go, well, maybe, but maybe just no one really care that much. And you'll be surprised when you do bomb how little, you know, when you first bomb, you think, that's the end of my career.
Yeah.
You know, you go home going, these people will tell everyone in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And no one, but really, they won't even remember who you were the next day.
No, they won't. I say, some guy wasn't very good. I can't remember what his name was.
Yeah, I can't remember his name or what he really looks like.
Yeah. And I'll get him mixed up with someone else. And yeah.
Yeah. So people worry about this stuff like way too much. Yeah. But you did get a few people who were sort of mocking it. I had a couple of people when it was sort of going actually quite well, but still wasn't, you know, it's still pretty peripheral. They were, a few people kind of mocked it and all this sort of stuff. And then years later, now they're the people that try and hit me up for finals tickets.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember.
Yeah. Or do a charity gig at their primary school. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How many of it? I mean, you get, I never knew how many friends I had until footy, you know, charity footy events roll around.
Yeah, well, this is true. But I mean, it is sad though, because now with COVID, you won't be doing all the gigs that normally come up this time of year, and you know, with because obviously you're not going to Brisbane, so
no, it's like a farmer whose harvest time has been cancelled. Basically, there's two sides to it, and I imagine you're feeling this a bit too. Is one, the pure money, not that we're, you know, solely in it for the money, being the wonderful artists we are.
That's
but,
right.
You know, you need money to live, unfortunately. So there's that aspect of it. But the bit I miss is it was just, they were the fun bits about the job. You know, writing a book or something is fine and I like enjoy it when it's done, but that's a real grind.
Yeah.
But the fun was going to an event or having a really great gig and then catching up with some comedians afterwards and going out for a bite to eat or something. They were the fun bits and all those bits are gone.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I find the Zoom phenomenon with comedy, I find
Have you done any?
No, I've avoided it. I have a kind of a strong view on it. I know this isn't, well, I know this isn't like for everyone, but
I've done a lot of them.
Oh. Yeah, so I don't know how you find it because I've got kind of one view that often the money is, when I've been asked, has been so bad as to be not worth the effort of turning on your computer. So it's cents on the dollar of what you do if you've got a live gig. So there's kind of like, well, can I be bothered? But secondly, I think a little bit with stand-up, and I don't know if you tweak it a fair bit to make it work for Zoom, but I've kind of got a view that stand-ups actually have an instrument, and that's actually the audience.
We play to the audience.
We actually play the audience, you know, and whether it's them being shocked or laughing or angry or whatever, that's kind of a big part of the thing. And I think it's a bit like saying to Jimi Hendrix, here, do a stand, you know, we want you to come on and do a Zoom thing, but you're not allowed to bring your guitar. It's a bit like, so I don't know if you find that. I don't know how you manage to get around it.
Look, sometimes smaller groups, they just leave all their mics open so you can hear them laughing. And other bigger groups, I often interact with. I interact with someone, like I do.
Yeah, that would help.
I've also got a whole set of Zoom gags. I've got the Wuhan bat puppet. I've got.
But that to me is you're putting on a mini comedy show more than
it is.
Actual stand-up gig.
It is. It's like a mini sort of TV kind of thing. And look, some of them say, we just want you to do half an hour stand-up, you can't interact with anyone, and I just sit here and do it. I know Tahir, he is a machine, and I've got right here, that he hits when you make a joke. So when you make a joke, you go... Hear that sound of laughter? Which I haven't resorted to yet, but I've got it here just in case. I'm doing a group of engineers. I think you always get good feedback from them. And
that's good.
Look, the first one I ever did, there were a few comics on before me, and they both freaked out and both said stuff like, oh, I don't know, what's happening? Is this working? Should I stop? all this sort of stuff. And I just thought, why am I going to do that? I'm going to pretend... like it's a great fun, and so that's what I did. And if you can't hear them, I just use the chat function, which is like a message function down the side of Zoom, as a bit of interaction sort of stuff. So it's different from stand up. It's still a performance, but it's definitely different from stand up. And I've pivoted. Is that the word? I didn't intend to, and I turned them all down at first, and then. Some of the money was reasonable. I thought, I'll have a crack. And then I've just started doing them a lot.
I think the ones I've been offered are kind of like, come do an hour stand-up.
That's what, you can't do an hour. I say half an
and
hour.
And I'm like, well, so it's fine, but I'm just sort of...
Also, someone like you, I do a lot with Husey, where we just bounce back and forth. And I've done them with, I do some with Kitty Flanagan. You should do, especially with football coming up, do it with like one of your mates, like Danny McGinlay, and you just need someone to make laugh and have fun, and the half an hour goes like that. I think
I've been asked to do a couple of charity ones I'm going to do, but I'm going to sort of do it more Q&As.
Yeah, people do so that too. Yeah,
riff off, before. Yeah. But it's interesting, and it sort of makes you wonder, when's it all going to come back? Is it going to come back for next year or not? But it's so hard to tell. I mean, who would have predicted 3 months ago that we'd still be where we were, where we are now. So it's sort of, I'm lucky because I write books, so I can always just write a book. And even a, airborne disease can't stop that much to some people's annoyance.
Well, you're a smart man. When will we be back doing live gigs? I kept saying to my wife, October we'll be back, but it's not going to happen now. And now I'm thinking next year, I don't know if like the comedy festival will go ahead. I don't know what will happen next year. I don't know, in Melbourne.
I just think it's going to be so, it's so reliant on things we can't predict.
Yes.
Which, does Victoria get it to the point where they can start to have 50 people in a room and, again. So, or is it bubbling along all the time, and every time they do it, it has a large spike again. So,
yeah.
I'm sort of pessimistic that even by comedy festival time, there'll be something, but then it gets down to like, you can have maybe 20 people tops in a room.
Is it worth
spread
it?
Out.
Then? Yeah, is it worth
That's
it?
That's right. Yeah. Like if it's a room that could normally fit 100 and they let you have 20, that's going to be an odd experience. So,
I mean, we've all done gigs like that, but we don't search out gigs like that. We turn up and they go, we've had a poor turnout. Gary's 21st is on across town, so there's only 20 blokes here at the Corio Footy Club. So, we could cancel it, but, all right, we'll go on. Sort of like that.
Well, you could say that many of our gigs in the past have been, sort of adopting social distancing from early on. So that's right. I mean, at least now you can blame social distancing and say... Yes. Just because there's 5 people in a room that can fit 1,000, that's just us being extra careful. Yeah. Not the terrible ticket sales I've been experiencing.
Hey, now I'm going to ask you my questions. I'll let you go because I know you've got stuff to do. I've got these 3 questions I ask everyone. What was the last thing you cooked, Titus?
Last thing I cooked? Gee, because instantly in my mind comes alcohol, which shows you how locked in, which I know is not a food.
But you're in charge of 2 small children, so you must be cooking for them. Surely you...
Yeah, we do, occasionally. I think the last thing I had was pretty boring, which was spaghetti bolognese.
Oh, yum.
The,
still good,
you know,
still good.
Still good, still and good. The one thing that everyone will eat.
Yeah, I know, with kids. Your kids are little, too. I made hot dogs for lunch, and they were beautiful. Oh, yum.
We've been doing a fair bit of takeaway, I have to say.
Yeah, well...
You get to the end of the day and you really can't be bothered half the time, and it's the only fun bit of the day.
Yes, you need a bit of joy in your life. Exactly. Yeah. My wife's scared of getting takeaway because of the virus and her mum's compromised and stuff. So she goes, we're going to make fake away, which means I have to cook something that's like takeaway. So,
which is never as good.
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not. I don't have the oil. I don't have a deep fryer. I don't have that.
No, we do a lot of toasties.
Yeah, that's a staple in our house, don't worry.
It's hard to go wrong.
What was the last thing you watched or listened to, Toss?
What am I currently watching? I actually just finished a show on Amazon called The Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Oh, I've seen that, yeah.
Stand-up comedy. Which I kind of felt... made me just miss going out and doing gigs even more, because there's all these moments where she just wanders down to do a set.
I know. She lives in New York, though, doesn't she?
But it's
a good show, but it's very wordy. And I couldn't get my head around, they talk a lot in it, and they talk in, and then I realized it's the woman who wrote The Gilmore Girls, which again was very wordy, which I like, but as soon as I found out that fact, I went, oh, that's what it is. It's like The Gilmore Girls, this show.
Well, you also know as a comedian that none of us are that interesting off stage.
Yeah. I mean, there are some great moments in it when she meets the legendary comic who does like a working class character and she's very posh in real life.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that bit. That was great.
And I do like meeting comedians that are... It is interesting when you chat to comedians and ones that you haven't known before. And they're completely different from their on-air persona.
Yes.
But it often doesn't run like they're different in a better way.
Well, I always remember...
It usually runs that they're worse off stage than they are on.
Oh, well, I mean, he's a lovely guy, but Arndo, I remember doing Good Newsweek with him, and he was backstage, and he's like, he's telling me... He went to St. Aloysius. He went to Tony Abbott's school, I think. He went to a very posh school.
Right.
He got a scholarship and he goes, yeah, I'm a lawyer. My wife's a lawyer. I live in he was living in the North Shore, eastern suburbs. And the producer goes, we're on in 5 minutes, boys. He puts on a flannelette shirt and walks out there and goes, how's it going, everybody? I'm from Yagoona, which is like a western suburb of Sydney and stuff. I'm like, wow, what happened?
That you hide it very well that you're actually... an elite Scotch boy,
yeah. That's right. Well, no, to tell you the truth, I worked at Scotch College as a cleaner, which is when I was at uni. So I do know halls. Yeah, I know those halls very well. it is a beautiful building, Scotch College.
Hundreds of millions of dollars should give you a good building, shouldn't they?
I know. Look, I went to a high school and I've always had a vendetta against those schools. And I think, you know, they should be closed down and turned into theme parks. Because as we were driving past Xavier College, which is a very impressive building in Melbourne, the most expensive boys' Catholic school in Melbourne, probably. My son looked out the window and said, when he was a very little kid, he said, Dad, it's Hogwarts. And I said, it's not Hogwarts, it's an arsehole factory. So, that's a bit of my stand-up. And that always offends. There's so many Xavier boys out there. I always offend a Xavier boy. But anyway.
Don't you find it weird, though, like, if someone tried to offend me by what school I'd went to, I'm like, I can barely remember going to school.
I know, same here. I can't.
And I don't feel any, like, massive connection to it. Like, it's a bit like someone bringing up that I used to work somewhere 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, none of the people that were there when I was there are even there anymore. So it's not like I walk around in my school blazer every day, but some people do.
Yeah. And what was the last bit of human contact you had? That was my final question.
Oh, now you're going to make me cry.
Oh. Look, you're going to be the Uber Eats delivery person. Doesn't matter.
No, yeah, well, that would be it. Seriously, I think I haven't been leaving the house much because of... I think the last time I actually saw people face-to-face was I was on the front bar about a month ago.
Oh, there you go. My God. Wow. So that would sadly be Mick Malloy, Sam Pang and Andy. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and we got to, you know, and they have the beer on the bar, which is tap beer.
Great.
So that was nice because, you know, at the moment you can't get tap beer.
Yeah.
And so that was probably the last bit of proper human interaction I had face-to-face with anyone.
Wow.
It's been pretty lonely.
Man.
That's mainly because I don't have friends, nothing to do with the actual lockdown.
You have children too, so anyway, it doesn't matter. We can't delve too much in your personal life.
But even that is not the same as adult contact.
I know, especially if they're really little. I mean,
they're terrible drinkers, Dave, I'm going to tell you.
But my 11-year-old talks about computer games. I'm just like, oh my God, was I like this when I was 11? I can't remember. Just going on about Minecraft.
Feigning interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love having kids. All kids are great and all that sort of stuff. And it is fun. You have amazing moments and stuff. But no one tells you how much of it is actually boring.
Yes. Well, the park, for example, is the most boring place.
Yeah. And then people frown when you're on your phone while your kids are playing, like you're missing precious memories. But I don't know.
My dad never took me to the park ever. So our dad's, I'm older than you, but in the 70s and the 80s, there was no park. There was no play equipment at the park near my house. It was just like a field. So,
yeah, well, and also just having interest in what you were feeling and thinking.
No, there's none of that. No.
Yeah, so, I mean, like when parents now say to me, do you worry about X or Y? Whatever the... I say, my kids have been born into a Western country, rich Western country, in the middle class. It's on them. Whatever happens is on them. Yeah. They can't make it work from here. They're fed and clothed every day. Like, they've been given an advantage most children in history have never had.
Yes.
And I'm not going to sit around and worry if they can't make it work from here. It's on them.
I think you should write a parenting book. I'd buy it.
But it is true. People worry. Yeah. I mean, I know. I'm not saying you shouldn't and people don't have real worries, but a lot of parents worry about things, and I think, was I constantly entertained as a child?
No.
Or were you bored and had to invent your own stuff? But they're kids now.
Yeah.
They're the generation that if you want to watch something, imagine you and I growing up, if someone said to you, at any moment on your phone, you can get any song in the world you want.
That's amazing.
It's just, we take it for granted now, but that would have just, and so living in that, I remember waiting, we used to wait months to go and hire WrestleMania from the VHS store.
But also waiting for the song to come on the radio and hoping that the DJ wouldn't speak over it.
Okay, and
taping it on the cassette. Here it comes. Okay.
Yeah. And then kids today, they're like, why can't I have this now? And for us, there was a lot of stuff that you went, of course you can't have it now. That's what life is. Some bastard that has borrowed The Fugitive from Blockbuster Video.
Yeah. You've turned up at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night. You're an idiot.
So. I can't even track down a copy of The Fugitive. I'm living the movie.
Well, Titus, great to chat to you. And follow Titus on Twitter. That's his big thing, Titus O'Reilly. He's got 250,000 followers. That's incredible. Check him out. Titus O'Reilly, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.